My name's John Kirst. I'm managing partner of My Wine Guide LLC.
Great. Good. So, you know, walk us through your background and, you know, you're a Philly guy and got out to San Francisco somehow and and seemingly done a lot of great things out there and then came up with an idea for an app. So you want to walk us through some of that?
Okay, yeah. So I grew up in Philadelphia, went to high school here and then had the crazy idea in 1974 to go to California. College. I graduated from Stanford. Then for a brief period I came back here, worked in the city, then went to up to New England to Dartmouth Tuck School for my MBA, graduated there in 1983, and at that point I left for California for good and landed in Silicon Valley. My wife was all for it. She came along, even though she's from Pennsylvania as well, and I began my career in the Silicon Valley at that point, and I've been just so fortunate to have experienced over 35 years now of technologies forming, technologies maturing, new technologies cropping up, business cycles, a lot of global, international business activity. My first company was a company called Rome, and Rome was the first company to basically put a computer in a telephone switch. Before that, you had people plugging things around, and then when you put a computer into the telephone switch, all kinds of opportunities started cropping up. And ultimately, Rome was sold to IBM for a record amount, a transaction of $2 billion in the mid-80s, which was a record for Silicon Valley at the time. And I spent 7 years with Rome, then got connected with a small group of folks, seven of us to be exact, who founded a company called Edify. And we basically got some VCs to believe in us, even though we just had a couple pieces of paper at that point. And they funded us. Edify, founded in 1990, went public in 1996. Basically, Edify built the very first software platform for internet banking. And we sold the company in 1999 after being public for 3 years. I did business at Edify around the world. We provided internet banking in Japan, China, Australia. It was a great experience. I then had an opportunity to be part of a new company that in some ways was a child of Edify, a company called Tuvox. And Tuvox was a pioneer in the use of natural language understanding technology, voice and text, to automate processes in customer service organizations. And our customers were everyone from American Airlines to big banks to AMC Theaters, Apple as well. We provided Apple's automated customer support for the launch of the very first iPod. And we sold that company in 2010. I then ended up in the cybersecurity space with a company called ThreatMetrics. We did business again around the world, trying to prevent, you know, hacking into e-commerce sites, bank sites, you know, just about anybody with a website or an app with an application, you know, that's vulnerable to hacking. And that was a very interesting technology because you had to find these fraudsters around the world, and they are very clever in how they cloak what they do. So you had to essentially pierce through that, and it's a very fascinating platform. We provided it to the likes of eBay and PayPal and a lot of large, vulnerable companies. Sold that company for $835 million. A couple of years ago, I, after that, joined a company called Sequent, which took me purely into the mobile space. And again, very global business, but basically mobile payments on your smartphone and digitizing credit cards and taking what was basically a physical wallet and putting it into your phone. So very similar to what you do today with Apple Pay. Mm-hmm. We did Apple Pay on the Android side, basically, and provided mobile payment systems in Saudi Arabia, Vietnam, throughout the world. And that really, really heightened my interest in mobile experiences, mobile use cases. And having spent some time with Sequent, I decided it was time to really pursue a passion and combine essentially my love of software with wine and food. Hmm. And that started my wine guide. And we worked on my wine guide, as you often do in the Silicon Valley, on the side while you still have your daytime job. We did that for a while, and we prototyped and we piloted it. And then about 18 months ago, we formed the company, built an engineering staff, and really started building out not only the app, but the software platform that the app is basically driven by. So we had a notion that basically there were two problems to solve, a consumer problem and a problem that restaurants have. And those problems are very symbiotic. They are connected in a way where we thought we could provide one solution for both those problems. And the one problem on the consumer side is the wine list challenge. Wine lists have been mystifying, if not confusing, if not intimidating, for a long, long time. And many, many consumers struggle with trying to make decisions about wine off a wine list. And the restaurants really don't have a whole lot of good options other than try to train staff and have sommeliers and things like that. So we thought, first of all, we could model algorithmically individuals' preferences for wine, even if they know next to nothing about wine, very little about wine. We could build algorithmically a model that would basically pattern their preferences. And then at the same time, we could point our software basically at online restaurant wine lists and extract data elements into our database that would align with that recommendation algorithm and produce basically person by person customized recommendations at the restaurant or before you go to the restaurant. It's all GPS driven, so we have about 3,000 restaurants that are supported in the app. That's growing every day, likely to be somewhere around 10,000 restaurants by the end of the year. And a consumer just identifies the restaurant by location or pulls down a list by location, picks a restaurant, and up pops their recommendations for red and white wine. Entirely personalized for them. They get kind of a Netflix match score, so they know what is closest to their preferences, but also maybe not perfectly close, but close enough that maybe you ought to try that wine that you've not had before. But it's similar characteristically to what you do like. So one of the great, great pieces of feedback we get from our users is that not only guides them, as the name implies, but it helps them think of some things that might not be in their immediate comfort zone and go try something else. Now, it turns out that that's something the restaurants love, because restaurants, if you think about it, the dynamic of someone at a restaurant looking at a list, trying to pick a wine, a restaurant providing a list, trying to offer wine, Well, if you think about it, it probably hasn't changed since printing press. Mm-hmm. There's been no innovation there. Mm-hmm. It's been the same dynamic forever and ever. So with the app in hand and knowledge of the restaurant wine list, we essentially provide the restaurants with a marketing platform for their wine list and enable them to sell more wine, basically, and just make the experience that much more interesting for their patrons. So attract more patrons. And so here we are trying to help the consumer, but we're also trying to help the restaurateur build their business, drive more revenue, attract more patrons.
And so you're looking at it like the customers are both the restaurant and the consumer.
Yes, that's a good question. Who is our customer? Yeah. Well, we think of them as both of them as our customers. We are constantly working on the app to make the consumer experience that much more compelling. A lot of our consumer customers just want to see us add more and more restaurants. Mm-hmm. So we're always investing in that. And there are literally tens of thousands of restaurants out there that are potential for the app. But our customer in an economic sense is the restaurant. Mm-hmm. And it is through the restaurant industry that we will monetize the app. So basically, we will launch later this spring a set of marketing and promotional services that are configured in the application that basically enable a restaurant to get more patrons comfortable with buying a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. You know, our son, 32-year-old son, came up with a great description of this. He said, "Dad, you know, we go to a restaurant with friends, a bunch of us. The wine list gets passed around. Everybody shrugs their shoulder and orders a bottle of beer." And you know, when he said this, I said, "JC, his name's JC, you lose out. You and your friends lose out on the wine experience. And by the way, where wine is at its best with food, mm-hmm. but." Even more interesting, maybe from a business standpoint, is the restaurant loses out on a high margin revenue driving item. And in the restaurant industry, there are many, many, many restaurants whose business really depends on selling beverages mm-hmm. to the point where they break even on food mm-hmm. and their profit is driven by beverage sales. So it makes a huge difference to a restaurant. We hear from restaurants numbers like 20-30% of their patrons buy a bottle of wine. Mm-hmm. If that number could go from 20% to 35%, or from 30% to 45%, that is a huge benefit mm-hmm. to their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And it helps them really realize the investment they make in wine and the trouble they go to build a wine list and source different kinds of wine and interesting wine. And they spend a fair amount of money doing that. But there really hasn't been a marketing avenue. So we have restaurants who promote My Wine Guide to their patrons. We do that several ways at the point, time, or just following when someone makes a reservation. There can be a communication about, you know, we partnered with My Wine Guide. Take a look at this app, and it will help you get some ideas about wines that would suit your preference. But not only preference, occasion. You know, how much do they really want to spend on a bottle of wine on Tuesday night versus Saturday night? So the app offers suggestions for things like school night, mm-hmm. lesser priced, or special occasion, et cetera. So we try to build recommendations that really try to address the occasion and then also the food. There's a food component of the app as well. But basically, the restaurant has many options where they can promote the app. And then once they do that, they can do things like offer discounts on wine purchases. They can communicate about new and interesting wines. And the restaurant has considerable amount of data. about its patrons. All anonymized, no personally identifiable information, but data that can give them some insight and intelligence about what their patrons like, where they dine, what they tend to do, what they tend to spend, you know, all in anonymized data.
So it's taking the education part, like you mentioned before, the sommelier or the waiter, you rely on a human to tell you about wine and whether it's their own preference or they actually really know something about it. And I've been in situations like that where, you know, it gets passed around and then somebody orders something else. But, you know, it's really, and we talked about this before, about the differences, and it's an educational platform for people, consumers, to learn at their, without being embarrassed before they go into a restaurant.
Yeah, yeah. The wine industry doesn't do a particularly good job of simplifying things for the consumer. So it's a little bit mystical out there. And we try to really kind of take it down to some basics. Mm-hmm. And you can get an education because you'll learn that, well, this wine is made of a Grenache grape. And okay, so why should I be interested? Well, a Grenache grape kind of tastes like this. Your tastes are like this. That's why we matched you up. Someone who, for instance, really likes Pinot Noir, that they know. But what they don't know is Grenache grown in a number of places is going to be a similar experience. Mm. So give that a try. There's a good chance you might like it. If you like big, rich Chardonnay, but you want to try something else, well, try a Rouzan or a Viognier. Mm-hmm. Not the same, but similar characteristics. So this is where we introduce, you know, new thoughts about wine, but try to keep it, you know, simple.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked earlier also that the differences, you know, as you mentioned, there's a bunch of wine apps, and that's kind of a ubiquitous term now after talking to you, that, you know, there's a group of wine apps that are just selling wine, and then it's some that don't really have much to them, and then My Wine Guide is really, as you mentioned before, foundation on technology and artificial intelligence. Sounds like it's almost like you've been training for this your whole life, you know, all the places you worked, and you've come to be able to merge your passion together. That's a really great story. But you want to talk more about the differences, you know, the other wine apps and what you spend a lot of time describing it, but just maybe, you know, the technology behind it, which seems really unique.
Yeah. So basically, question, how is My Wine Guide like or different from other wine apps? And there are wine apps out there that perform very well. What you'll see in those apps almost always is a app that's built to help you buy their wine, either wine they inventory or wine they can broker. And their business model is all about selling retail wine on a retail basis. That's how they monetize their business, and the app experience is really built around that. And there are several very good apps for doing that. And maybe a lot of people are familiar with taking a picture of a wine label and doing something like that. I have those apps, they're great apps. But My Wine Guide is the only wine app that has specifically targeted an experience that works, is addresses specifically restaurants. We're the only app to have attempted this, and specifically in a way where we can scale the app with literally thousands of wine lists from thousands of restaurants. No one has ever done that. We currently have about 3,000 restaurants supported in the app. I think we'll be to about 10,000 by the end of the year. If you think about that as a business, you clearly can't do that in a manual way. The only way to make that business sustainable is to build software to automate a lot of things. And that's where myself and the engineering team have built up a lot of experience over the years. We've built numerous types of software platforms that basically automate a wide range of things. And in this case, we automate the whole process of, okay, what restaurants have wine lists online? We crawl the web, we find those restaurants, we find the wine list on the restaurant site. We break it down into the data elements we need to make it work with our recommendation algorithm. We take all that data into our database. So I think it is safe to say we already have the world's largest database of restaurant wine lists, with over 1 million wine listings already, and we've only been at this 5 months.
Is the wine algorithm subject to patent?
Yes, and this whole process that I'm about to describe, we have filed a provisional patent application on the whole system and method. So as we bring this data down into the My Wine Guide platform, it is modeled in a way that drives the recommendation algorithm and basically populates the recommendations you see as a consumer in the app. And so this is how you can literally open up the app at the restaurant and we suggest, hey, John, are you at Park Restaurant in Philadelphia? Do you want recommendations? We do that obviously with GPS location based, and you say yes, and immediately your recommendations are there.
How does a wine user get started with the app?
So yeah, that's a very interesting point, because when someone downloads the app for the first time, we know nothing about their preferences. And this is a very tricky thing that we worked very hard on over several years to really optimize through a lot of piloting and trialing and in an onboarding process, if you will, of asking you some number of questions. All those questions and are answer dependent. So depending on what you know about wine, how little you might know, how much you may already know about a preference, to are you very, very knowledgeable about wine, the app will take you through a varied flow of a set of questions which shouldn't take you more than 30 seconds to complete. So we've worked very hard on trying to get the information we need to build a basic preference set from people that know virtually nothing about wine to people who know a fair about wine.
So for me, I know what I like. And so is some of the questions, like I could answer questions about if you know, what's your favorite Cabernet? I'd say Chateau Madalena, I'd say that, or Heights. Does it, you know, for people like me, does it have you compare it to something that you like, or do you have to say answer other questions like that?
Right. So how we build this works off the fundamental preference in the recommendation algorithm, which in that preference, that premise being, wine is about place. If you think about all the wines in the world, and you know, restaurants go to great lengths to source wine from, you know, virtually every corner of the globe, you may have a preference for Cabernet. Cabernet Sauvignon is made in many, many places in the world. And guess what? It varies tremendously where it's made. Mm-hmm. So Cabernet Sauvignon sourced from the Napa Valley floor is characteristically different from Cabernet Sauvignon sourced on the mountainside of Napa.
Oh, wow.
So we literally build different characteristic parameters. Wow. For just that subtle difference. Now extend that to is it Cabernet Sauvignon from Bordeaux? Is it from the left bank or is it from the right bank? That's different, right? Australian, Chilean, Cabernets have a certain set of characteristics. Some people might say, well, those are characteristically New World characteristics. But if you think about Chardonnay, Chardonnay from Chablis, France, very different from a Chardonnay from Carneros, California. So the wine is about place really drives a lot of that question and answer, because we're trying to get a sense of, okay, so you like Cabernet Sauvignon, you know that, but then kind of where do you like your Cabernet Sauvignons to come from, is the next part. If you give us that information, we'll take that a little bit further. So there are about 300 different outcomes from that 30-second questionnaire process. 300 possible different outcomes.
Wow. So what are some sample questions asked on the...
Well, one of the first questions we ask is, do you have a familiarity with wines from certain countries that you have a preference for? Do you like wines from California? Do you like wines from Spain? Wines from Chile? Mm-hmm. We're starting to get, you have a location preference that you've thought about? Mm-hmm. And then if we start to get a sense of, okay, where from do you like wines? Then we'll take you to some common varietals. We'll ask you about Cabernet Sauvignon and we'll ask you about Pinot Noir, and we'll see if you're familiar with the varietals. You may be, you may not be. Mm-hmm. And the onboarding and questions can respond to that. Mm-hmm. We do that separately for red, and we do it separately for white. Mm-hmm. Very different, you know, just people can have one set of wine, white wine preferences, different set of mm-hmm. red wine preferences. Mm-hmm. So we make an important distinction there.
So we're sitting in Offa Kerman's offices in Philadelphia, your hometown, and I know Matt D'Annunzio, high school friend of yours, helped with some protecting some of the IP and the patent work. Can you tell us a little bit about the experience that you had, you know, working with Offa Kerman and doing that?
Yeah,
and how important it is to, especially in the app world, to protect your IP.
Right. When we formed the company, you know, one of the first things you do is find a good attorney. And I've had a great long friendship with my best friend from high school, Matt D'Annunzio at Offutt Kerman. I called up Matt. I said, would you be interested in representing us? You know, we're not a big business, but hopefully someday we will. And funny thing, Matt has a great love for food and you know, probably knows is a fair amount about wine as well, but he could see the value in what we're doing right away. And he could see how restaurants would have this business problem that they'd love to address. So we started working on some of the basics to form the company. And then it became time to look at the intellectual property. Having done business in the Silicon Valley for many years and have been with companies where patents were created routinely, numerous of them, I wasn't always directly involved with them, but you know, that's something I've seen quite a bit. And so Matt and I talked about, is this something we should invest in and start doing? And I think a number of our investors have felt similarly, that we have some very unique intellectual property and we should work on protecting it. So I recall mentioning this to Matt a few months ago, and literally within 10 days we had one of his partners working on the patent. We had a little bit of a deadline. We weren't aware of it, but it has to do with UK law and advance notice if we wanted to apply the patent in the UK, which we do. So we very quickly worked through this in order to hit a deadline, And the Offutt Kerman team was just on it all over Labor Day weekend. I have told others that in the Valley about our experience, and that they are just awed by it, that an initial patent process could go that quickly and smoothly, and really would very little effort on our part. Offutt Kerman team got an understanding of what we do and why it's significant amazingly fast.
Awesome. So are you, you talked a little bit about internationally, as you know, for certainly where the wines are grown, but and then mentioned about the protection in Europe. Do you have restaurants internationally that are signed up for the app to use the app?
We haven't launched internationally yet.
Okay.
But it's very important to us. It's a big part of my business background, having done business a lot overseas. And so we have a familiarity with certain countries, certain markets, where we're pretty confident that both the consumers and the restaurants have the same problem they have here in the United States. If you think of the UK, certainly London, that's a great opportunity for us. We'll probably pursue London and the UK later this year in 2020. Again, you know, and wine is kind of a universal language. You know, it doesn't really get translated. So that of course, Canada. I have done quite a bit of business in Asia, and I think in Japan, in China, Hong Kong, there are the same opportunities for this, and maybe even more so, because in those countries, people are just becoming more. They're earlier on in their wine experience.
And they're going to stop drinking Corona beer, so, you know.
Yeah.
Bad joke.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. I mean, I didn't ask me a question. You really went through most of everything, this story. What more do you want to... you know, what more do you want to say about the app, or if we envision putting in the other video or other questions I may have? Is there any more to talk through how the app works? I think you pretty covered that pretty well.
Yeah, I think.
How about how the profile modifies? And
well, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Right,
yeah.
How do you modify the profile?
So we talked about how we onboard the new user, and that initial preference is established. That's our starting point. And from there, we can make very good recommendations. And we get a lot of positive feedback that was one sommelier in particular. Just several weeks ago, he downloaded the app. He looked at the recommendation set, and he said, you nailed it. You completely nailed me. And this is sommelier. Mm-hmm. But once the initial preference is established, it's important to refine it, because there's much more information out there when our users decide to order a bottle of wine, and then we prompt them to give us a rating. And then that rating is feedback input into the algorithm. It updates their profile every time a user rates a wine. That rating gets factored into their profile and their preference set. So you may start off in a certain place in the algorithm that drives a certain set of preferences, but those could get modified over time as we learn more about your preferences.
It becomes smarter as a user.
Yeah, absolutely smarter. Yeah. You know, it's a classic thing in software. The more data, the smarter we can be,
right,
in software. It works that way across the board. And then the other nice thing is in the app, we keep a history for you that you just access with a tab on the app of all the wines you've rated, and you can sort them by, well, where did I have that wine? Well, I had it at Park, and that goes into your memory, and we find a lot of people have said, you know, I know I ordered a wine, I know I liked it, I've forgotten what it is, and I've forgotten where I had it. Well, this keeps a history of all that. You can sort it by varietal and region and where you had it and when you had it and how you rated it and so forth.
Wow. That's amazing.
Now, he grows Pinot Noir.
Oh, yeah.
You may want to ask
well,
him.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And,
so,
and do you want to give him a plug for Six Mile Bridge?
So, good question. Do you have a vineyard and do you raise?
Yeah. So where did this wine thing all start?
Yeah.
As I think I mentioned earlier, I went out to California in the 70s to Stanford, and at that time Napa Valley was just becoming a thing, and it we were pretty quick to take a few trips up there, mm-hmm. and taste some wine for free, as starving college students. So we took advantage of that, and myself and some other friends, we really got our first love of wine started. From there, I think, wine is just about what you like. But the more you can drink wine from different places in the world and see those differences and figure out whether you like them or not, you just start to understand why, mm-hmm. Understand why it started in places like Europe, where it was all about food, wine mm-hmm. and food. It was the beverage with food, and still is mm-hmm. in those cultures, in those countries. And then, my wife and I literally have a bottle of wine with dinner every night. Mm-hmm. Years and years of watching people experience wine and drink wine has been fascinating, because I can go through our extended family and they all have different palates and they all have different preferences. And then along the way, we bought some property and planted a vineyard. It's in Woodside, California, kind of cool growing location. So it's planted in Pinot Noir, which requires a cooler climate, and we just we grow it and we make it. We just did our 20th vintage of Pinot Noir. So, I think there's something to be said for actually having made wine and understanding a little bit about the chemistry and why things happen the way they do in a fermenting bunch of grape juice, and what happens in the vineyard that sets that all up with certain tastes and so forth, and acid levels and tannin levels and all those things. You get another understanding of the dimensions of wine.
Our vineyards would be another target, another consumer of the app?
That's a good question. Wine producers, we do see wine producers as an opportunity for us longer term. And that is because in the wine producer world, producers are proliferating every year. Mm-hmm. There are places where the number of producers, places in California where the number of producers have gone from 50 to 400 in a period of 15 years, mm-hmm. That kind of growth. Those producers are highly reliant on distribution, especially if they're going to distribute to restaurants. And today, almost by law, almost uniformly by law, those wine producers have to find a distributor to sell into state XYZ. Mm-hmm. It's the law. And at the same time, while these wine producers have grown in numbers, the number of distributors has actually declined in the United States through a process of just buying up and consolidating, and certain distributors just becoming bigger and bigger and more dominant. And a lot of that industry is about scale. So the wine producer who is relatively new, trying to get to market, say 2,000 cases of wine, 5,000 cases of wine, is really got a bit of a problem. In a lot of cases, those big distributors don't want to take on that size of wine producer or winery. Importers have similar problem. And yet those producers, those importers are typically making product, sourcing product that really is the restaurant level kind of wine that we work with. So we have envisioned a part of the business eventually. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail about it, but just suffice it to say we'd connect the restaurants with whom we do business with those wine producers directly. Mm-hmm. And there's some ways to do that in a more current day, digital fashion.
Beautiful. Yeah, awesome. We have a couple of clients, wine producers. Black Ankle in Mount Airy, Maryland, was number 63 on the top 100 wines in the country a few years ago. And they brought in Napa Valley grapes or vines, and then they're in a bowl in the hills of Maryland. It's very, very beautiful. Mm-hmm. They have it's a sustainable tasting room that's hail bale constructed, green roof.
Cool.
All the trees they cut down, they used inside the room for furniture and chairs and things like that. And so it's an organic farm as well as a winery. And then another one's Great Frogs in Annapolis and Crow Farms in, it's on the Eastern Shore in Betterton, Maryland.
Well, wine today in the United States is produced in 48 of the 50 states.
Yeah, wow.
Well,
and then, you know, and I would guess, I know these places I mentioned, they also generate a lot of revenue on just tastings, you know, having events, tastings. They have cool spots, places for people who want to hang out. They bring in food trucks or catered food and you know, people congregate there, especially Black Ankle and Mount Airy. They have a great grounds that it's always, you know, packed there.
Yeah.
And then start wine clubs.
So when you think about those producers, my wine guide has a lot of data that is unique and valuable to them in the sense that when they do sell through distribution into different states, they obviously know how much they sold to that distributor, but they don't know where it went from there. It's very difficult for them to get any insight, intelligence about where their wine actually ends up, especially if it's going to a variety of restaurants. Mm-hmm. But we know exactly what wines are at what restaurants. Mm. So we could tell producer XYZ, your wines currently in the United States are on the wine list at all these restaurants. Wow. And because we update the database every night with whatever changes are made to those wine lists, we do that every night for the thousands of restaurants we cover, we can also tell that wine producer, well, your wines just went out of stock in these Chicago restaurants. Hmm. So maybe you want to get your distributor to start working on that. This information has never really been available.
Wow. That's a game changer.
It can be, yes. Yeah. So I think when you build a software company, part of what you think about is, are you building something that's hard to do, hard to replicate? Because there's value in that. And obviously, it's got to solve a compelling set of problems or it's not of much value. But if you find something that's going to solve compelling problems and at the same time it's a hard thing to do, now you have an asset and you have barriers to competitive entry and we think we're well positioned that way.
Awesome.
So another one of John's, the legend of John Kearse was his walking on to Stanford football program. I'll get a little soundbite about that.
Okay, so the question was, did I do anything at Stanford other than drink wine? I did study a bit, but other than that, I graduated from high school in Pennsylvania, thought my football career was over, and then I showed up at Stanford and two guys were on the team in our freshman dorm. After a little bit of catch and throw, convinced me that I ought to go walk onto the team. So I did have a couple years of playing next to James Lofton and Tony Hill and with NFL quarterbacks, and I was way out of my league, but it was a good time for a couple of years.
Well, and you've been, as you mentioned before, been through Silicon Valley's boom and bust and seen a lot of changes. I mean, what's, other than just the technology changing so much, is there anything that people don't know that would be interesting about Silicon Valley and the changes?
Yeah, so about Silicon Valley, it is such an amazing place because it attracts all kinds of talent and capabilities that you need to create new companies. It's just such a magnet for people that build companies and lead the different functions in a company. You combine that with the availability of capital, how the venture capital community has grown so significantly. It's obviously a wonderful place to live, great weather, and so it is an amazing place that reinvents itself constantly. When I started, a lot of the technologies were hardware-driven. Software was proprietary, and we there were the first personal computers and disk drives and semiconductors and things like that. And then we evolved into a lot of client-server type technologies that drove applications, and then all of a sudden applications drove a lot of innovation, and with that you needed databases, and so the advancements in database technology in the 90s were quite significant. And then there was the internet. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the day at Edify, about 1995, shortly after Netscape had launched with the Netscape browser, that a couple of our engineers came into my office and the CEO's office and said, "You know what, John and Jeff, there's this thing called the internet." And we said, "Oh, really?" And actually, to be more precise, the World Wide Web, because mm-hmm. the internet had existed, but now there was this World Wide Web on top of it. And we were taking our product in a certain direction, and that conversation with those two engineers changed things. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh my gosh, essentially we were providing self-service technology to a broad range of different businesses that had to automate processes. And now all of a sudden, the web became a whole new avenue of self-service applications. And that's ultimately what drove us from 7 people to 500 in 5 years, and in the Silicon Valley Fast 50 for 3 years. And but it's those kinds of things that happen along the way. And then now in the Valley, a lot of it is about applications. Mm-hmm. And my wife, as an example, she's had a career in health science technology. She's with a company now that is a company called Omada that's trying to provide essentially a preventative approach to healthcare and try to address things like chronic diabetes and cardiovascular issues. And there's a lot of smart people that work at that company, people that were doctors. In fact, the founder dropped out of Harvard Medical School to found this company. And there's all kinds of data and algorithmic technology that goes into this, but it's all delivered by an app. You use an app as the way to get this medical health counseling, which gets driven by a very sophisticated set of technologies in the back end. So the whole app world, there are some very, very simple apps, maybe on the surface, but behind those apps can be a lot of serious technology. I mean, that's one of the things we want to make sure we're doing, is that the app sort of is our face, but behind it is where we really add a lot of value.
Sounds like it. That's awesome.
Thank you.
I think we covered it.
Crushed it.
Yeah, that was great.